Hey, are council ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning. The next case on our calendar today is A22-0749, Robert John Kaiser versus State of Minnesota. Council will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, as you're aware, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording today's oral argument. The recording will be available on our website within 24 hours or so. So I'll just remind anyone who's watching that other recordings are not permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. To council, there is a timer available in the grid view. Hopefully you can see that. If there's any issues, let us know. And with that, council for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. I'll just ask that you identify yourself and the party you represent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, council. My name is Michael Lieberg. I'm the Chief Deputy Stearns County Attorney and represent the appellant, State of Minnesota, in this matter. During my time, I do intend to get to both bases that the post-conviction court found for a new trial. But while I was otherwise prepared for a brilliant argument based on laws existed at the time of briefing, this court's opinion in State v. Gilbert issued this week is really dispositive of some of the issues related particularly to the false evidence claim. So I want to kind of start there first. But before doing so, I do think it's
important. Can I stop you right off the bat and just, it's unusual to have the state appealing a post-conviction order. And I just want to make sure that doesn't alter our standard of review or anything else about how we view the case, correct?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. You may continue.
But it's important to recall exactly the nature of the false evidence in this case. And in some ways, the respondent's shifting basis for what that false evidence is. At trial, amongst a legion of other fact and medical evidence, the state offered the testimony of expert witnesses that the retinal hemorrhaging found in the child's eyes in this case, and including a macular schistus form of retinal hemorrhaging, was caused by abusive head trauma. In his petition for post-conviction relief, the respondent claimed that the state's evidence about the causes of all the child's retinal hemorrhaging, including the macular schistus, was false because the state's experts testified that nothing other than AHT could explain the retinal hemorrhaging. And he claimed that there were alternative causes in this case for the retinal hemorrhaging. And he also challenged the evidence as being false because of the child or the state's mechanism for that injury. The vitreal traction theory was also unsupported by the evidence. There was a 9-day evidentiary hearing in this particular case, after which the post-conviction court, which is important to note, was not the trial court in this case. The trial judge had retired, in this case was reassigned to a different judge, found that specific testimony from Dr. Schmidt and Dr. Lynch was false on the causes of macular schistus because it led the jury to believe there was no other cause for the macular schistus other than AHT. But the court also found that the state's...
Let me ask you this, Mr. Lieberg, just so I understand your argument. I think you agree with me that any testimony that macular schistus is only caused by abusive head trauma would in fact be false. But that I think you agree with that, don't you?
If the testimony was right. All types of schistus or retinoschisis, which is simply the splitting of the retina, is caused by abusive head trauma, that would be false. But that wasn't the testimony right. In this case.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood your
yes. If that had been the testimony, if one of the state's witnesses had got up and said all types of schistus, every type, including, you know, age-related, other types were caused by abusive head trauma, that would have been false. But again, that wasn't the testimony in this particular case. And again, the court drew a distinction between macular schistus as a form of retinal hemorrhage and the causes for it and the causes of retinal hemorrhaging. in a way that was incorrect. In this case, the macular sheesis, all the parties agree that the macular sheesis the child had was a form of retinal hemorrhaging. But the court somehow drew this distinction that the state's evidence about retinal hemorrhaging was not false, but the state's testimony about the macular sheesis was false, even though the state's evidence was that the causes of all those types of retinal hemorrhaging was the same, the vitreal traction theory and abusive head trauma. So in essence,
they drew- But isn't the distinction that these two doctors who testified, Drs. Schmidt and Dr. Lynch, found a particular causal and a sole causal connection between the macular sheesis and abusive head trauma? And I don't think they made such suggestions with respect to, you know, hemorrhages generally, but there was testimony about the macular sheesis, correct?
There was, but you have to read that in the context of the entire testimony, in particular, Dr. Lynch. Dr. Lynch had just got done testifying about all the various forms of retinal hemorrhaging, including a macular sheesis cavity. He was then asked a particular question about what did that macular sheesis form of hemorrhage mean to him. And he had said that in his career, he had not seen another cause. He then immediately went on to talk about causes of retinal hemorrhaging. So he wasn't drawing the distinction that the court drew. His reference then to causes of retinal hemorrhaging, including the macular sheesis.
Mr. Lieborg, he said, I think this is the part of the testimony you're referring to. And what does the fundus macular sheesis mean to you with regard to this case? Well, it's the kind of thing you see with the best abusive head trauma. Do you see it in other cases? I have. In other cases other than abusive head trauma? No. I don't think it's been described outside of abusive head trauma. That seems pretty definite to me.
And that was Dr. Schmidt's testimony, the forensic pathologist that later testified for the state.
I'm sorry. That I got those confused.
Yeah, it was Dr. Lynch, the ophthalmological, the pediatric, these medical terms are getting to me, the pediatric eye expert who was testifying about what the macular sheesis meant to him.
And he also said, so what's your opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty? When I see something like a macular sheesis cavity, it's in seeing a lot of kids' eyes. There really isn't any other type of cause of that I've seen in my career.
But immediately after that, he is asked about causes of retinal hemorrhaging. Part of it is read in context. Yes, the question asked about the macular sheesis, but the immediate question after that was about retinal hemorrhaging in general. The problem is that in this case, the macular sheesis is a form of retinal hemorrhaging. So when the doctors are talking about retinal hemorrhaging, that includes macular sheesis. There isn't a way that I see to separate the two when one is a form of retinal hemorrhages, certainly not in the way that the post-conviction court did. The post-conviction court basically said retinoscopus and retinal hemorrhaging are two different things. How can the state's evidence about retinal hemorrhaging and the causes not be false, but a form of retinal hemorrhage can be false? That's the point where I have a trouble reconciling those two. And to remind the court, that is not even the claim that respondent made in his petition for post-conviction relief. On appeal now, he is alleging that objectively it was false because there are other causes of sheesis in general. Okay, that's great. But what does that mean to this case, and why is that relevant that some other patient could have presented with a split retina and that there was another cause besides abusive head trauma? Why is that relevant? It isn't. The purpose of this expert's testimony was to explain the findings in the eye, the retinal hemorrhages, including the macular sheesis, and his testimony that abusive head trauma was the cause of all of the retinal hemorrhaging, including the macular sheesis. And again, that opinion is not false, in that is what he believes, that is what he stood by during the post-conviction hearing. And again, respondent's argument has shifted. It's not all forms were false and that there are other causes. It was objectively false. It was like, aha, this doctor said all forms of macular sclerosis are caused by abusive head trauma. That's wrong. I win because it's false testimony. And again, it,
counsel, perhaps it could, the district court, I think, found that that the testimony went beyond mere opinion and instead was presented to the jury as a matter of medical fact. And that was the district court's concern and basis for finding that the testimony was false.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But can you address that point? I know you addressed it in your brief, but I think that also, you know, is important in terms of Gilbert, which I know you were going to get to.
It is. But the bottom line is that there is really no difference when you have an expert who is allowed to give their opinion on the stand about the meaning of certain facts. Those are medical facts. And the jury was told what they could do with that information. So when a medical expert tells the jury, based on their training and experience, what the findings of this child's eyes meant to them, in essence, that is a medical fact. That's the purpose for their testimony, and that they're allowed to state that. It's not just a general fact. That's why you have an expert. They have that training and experience and be able to address that. And I agree that in some ways, Gilbert does address that. And I want to get to that in particular, because I do think it's dispositive. Without going through the facts of Gilbert, the one thing that they did address that is, well, they resolved two issues. One, the standard of review, which is for abuse of discretion, not clear error. And two, they also disposed of my argument that Larison isn't applicable to opinion testimony by finding that it was. But the one thing that they did do is identify what is false testimony. And that was a question that was asked of both parties during oral argument. And the court identified the three ways in which the defendant can show that there was false testimony. One is recanted testimony. The second is a post-trial statement materially contradictory to the trial testimony. And the third is other evidence that the state's witnesses testified dishonestly. And the use of the term dishonest was not accidental. Again, the court asked, what it means to be false. In choosing that term, dishonestly, at least as the dictionary definition, means deceitful. The use of the term implies almost bordering on perjury, which does bring it into line with the other two ways, recanted testimony and a post-trial statement contradicting, both indicate falsehood or a lie. And the court went on to find that simply another statement that contradicts that testimony, or if the witness did not give a fuller explanation of their testimony, does not constitute false testimony. That fuller explanation here would have been, yes, there are other causes generally of macular sclerosis, but again, when it was not relevant to the case and nobody believed that this child had a macular sclerosis that was not a type of retinal hemorrhaging, it was irrelevant for the expert to volunteer, yes, other people get a macular sclerosis, just not a hemorrhagic macular sclerosis. And again, like I said, that requirement that it be dishonestly given means that it can't just be incorrect. And somebody can't just come and say, haha, I found something in your testimony that was incorrect. Therefore, I have proven that there is false testimony. And the court also did give some guidance in particular on expert opinions and something I touched on in my brief. The opinions of both doctors here on the cause of the macular sclerosis were qualified. One doctor said he had not seen another cause in his career. not that there were no other causes. He had not seen one in his career. The other doctor said, I don't think it's been described outside of abusive head trauma. Both of those qualifications invited cross-examination.
I want to follow up, Mr. Liegberg. You were just talking, I think, about the Dr. Schmidt's testimony about, first he's asked if it's the kind of thing, the macular schisis cavity that you see with abusive head trauma. And he says, yes. And then when asked whether you see it in cases other than abusive head trauma, he says, no, I don't think it's been described outside of abusive head trauma. I think you're arguing that the kind of qualifying, I don't think language would suggest that it's not a statement of fact that could be false under the law. But isn't that really a decision that we defer to the district court's discretion on deciding whether that testimony was false or simply a statement of opinion?
It would be, and it might have been, if the district court judge in this case was the same as the post-conviction court. The post-conviction court did not have the benefit of seeing the actual testimony as it was given during trial. The court went back and reviewed the transcript. The court was able to make credibility findings based on the testimony that was given at the evidentiary hearing, but that wasn't the court. And I see I'm out of time. If I could finish my thought on that.
You may.
But the court didn't have that ability to assess the credibility and made no credibility findings. The court went on to find that they didn't believe that either Dr. Schmidt or Dr. Lynch provided deceitful testimony or intentionally did so. Just incorrect. Again, something that Gilbert pointed out is not false testimony. I will get to questions of ineffective assistance of counsel, hopefully in my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge Cochran, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford. I represent respondent Robert Kaiser, and I'm speaking with you this morning on behalf of the entire team of attorneys who volunteered their time to represent Mr. Kaiser in his post-conviction evidentiary hearing before the district court. This court should affirm the district court in all respects. The district court's 90-page decision is replete with factual findings fully supported by the record, and the decision reflects a correct application of those supported findings to the law. There simply is no error for this court to correct. The court's analysis must start with the standard of review, and I know there was some debate about the standard of review in the briefing, but both sides agree that the district court's factual findings are reviewed for clear error. And as this court knows, that standard is perhaps the most deferential known to law. The Minnesota Supreme Court stated in the Two Harbors decision that a district court's factual finding is clearly erroneous only when it strikes the reviewing court as wrong with the force of a five-week-old dead fish. That didn't happen here. The standard of review is critical here because the district court made robust factual findings following a two-week evidentiary hearing, and the findings that underlie its conclusions on ineffective assistance of counsel and submission of false evidence are fully and amply supported by the record. Let me start with ineffective assistance of counsel, and before I get to the district court's factual findings, I want to make two critical points right off the bat that I think are necessitated by the state's reply brief. And I want to make sure the parties are very clear on this and the court is very clear on this. What the district court's decision is not. The state contends on page 34 of its brief and on page 40 that the district court's order imposed some de facto requirement, a blanket requirement in every case that defense counsel consult with a particular expert in an abusive head trauma case. They call it a rigid requirement that counsel do so. That is not what this order is. This is a fact-specific order that the district court concluded counsel did not meet the objective standard in Strickland based on the particular facts of this case. And I'll refer the court to page 89 of Judge Morley's findings, where she even uses the phrase under these particular facts before concluding that the Strickland standard was met. there are facts that are unique to this case that you may not have in every AHT case.
But it seems like the trial counsel was the go-to person for the state public defender's office on AHT kinds of cases. And he held himself out as an expert on these kinds of cases. And so it was really strange for me to read an order that found him ineffective in this case when this is his area of expertise.
Yeah, so a few responses to that, Judge Riley. Number one, it's not a subjective standard. Strickland is an objective standard, what a reasonably competent lawyer would have done. Number one, there's no question that this trial counsel did some good things, but as Strickland made clear, the standard is not to grade counsel's performance overall. You take the specific omission and look at the circumstances of that particular omission and decide whether that meets the Strickland standard. And in this case, there really wasn't a good explanation, Judge Riley, that the district court could locate anywhere in the record for why Mr. Belfry did not consult either a radiologist or a neuroradiologist with respect to the CT and MRI scans, knowing that they would be the focal point of the state's case. And that's really the critical point here. Obviously, he consulted different experts, but in the cases that we've cited to in our brief, where courts have also found an effective assistance of counsel in AHT cases, those lawyers also consulted with other experts, particularly in the Hales case from the Supreme Court of Utah, which is virtually on all fours here. But we're not grading Mr. Belfry and what he subjectively did or didn't do. We're grading what a reasonable lawyer would have done. The other thing that I want to point out, I have to make this point because the state concluded its reply brief by saying, perhaps we should do away with ineffective assistance of counsel and just grant two trials. The first to try out one defense and a second if that one fails. I want to be very clear here. That line of argument implies that Mr. Kaiser's trial counsel made a strategic decision to withhold CVT as a potential defense and simply use it if the court were to grant a retrial. That is nowhere near what happened here. That argument ignores the district court's factual findings and the evidence supporting them. I'll refer the court to page 65 of the findings, where the court says, quote, the court also finds that petitioner and his attorneys did not know that William had CVT. Page 87, Mr. Belfry testified that had he known about CVT, he would have included it as part of his defense. And then page 87, the court finds this was not a strategic decision. To get where the state wants this court to go, you would have to upend Judge Morley's supported findings of fact that are fully supported by the record. And you would have to essentially ignore the unrebutted expert testimony from attorney Paul Ang. Now, the state has a couple arguments with respect to Mr. Ang that I think bear some discussion today.
Sorry. It seems to me Mr. Ang does suggest a scorched earth sort of defense in every case, the sort of bright line approach that the state is talking about. You're not advocating for that.
No, I'm not advocating for that, Your Honor. And in fact, the district court didn't impose a scorched earth requirement. And we are certainly not advocating a one size fits all bright line rule that in every AHT case, defense counsel has to consult with a radiologist. What we are saying and what Judge Morley said is
is it about this case that crosses the line between strategic investigatory decisions and an unreasonable investigative approach?
Sure. So in this case, Judge Bjorkman, I don't think there's any real dispute and the district court made a finding that the CT and MRI scans were going to be the focal point of the state's case. In this case, there was no eyewitness to the alleged abuse. So nobody came in and said, I saw Mr. Kaiser do this. There is no injury to the neck. And remember, this is a 2-month-old child, and the theorized mechanism of injury was a violent shaking. So you have no external injury to the neck. You may have AHT cases where the child comes in with clear fractures in the skull, for example, suggesting an impact, a clear neck injury, suggesting a shaking mechanism. In those cases, it may perfectly be reasonable for counsel to say, what the MRI shows really doesn't matter. The kid has a skull fracture. But the state was very clear, and its experts relied heavily on the CT and MRI scans, not only to prove that a shaking event occurred, but to prove the timing, because they said, well, there's these ruptured bridge veins that show the timing of the shaking, and they put the timing when Mr. Kaiser had custody of his son. And the CT scans are critical because our experts at the post-conviction hearing said not only do they show William had CVT, but they show there's really no torn or ruptured bridging veins consistent with the state's theory. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Some of the evidence that disturbs me, and I don't know how you fit this into your argument, but you say that there was no external injury indicative of assault. But I would consider the bruise on the cheek and the broken ribs that were healing indicative of assaults, because babies who aren't moving yet, those kinds of injuries don't happen absent an external kind of force.
Sure. So a few points on that, Judge Riley. There was testimony at trial and at the post-conviction hearing that prior rib fractures can be caused by a few different things. Number one, this is a two-month-old. You can actually even be born with rib fractures. Number two, there was evidence at trial about a previous stroller fall. And number three, and I think most importantly, Your Honor, the state charged Mr. Kaiser with first-degree murder based on a prior pattern of abuse. And the jury acquitted him of that charge, essentially concluding the state hadn't met its burden of showing that Mr. Kaiser had engaged in prior acts of abuse, which is why the rib fractures and bruising were submitted as evidence at trial. But the last point I'd make, Judge Riley, is the question really isn't at this stage, is there evidence in the record to support the conviction? The question that Strickland poses, is there a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different? And the Strickland court rejected a more likely than not standard. And here, Judge Morley, exercising her discretion, determined that under Strickland, that standard was met, notwithstanding the evidence that Your Honor has identified.
If we were to agree with you, say, on the ineffective assistance, but agree with the state on the false testimony, what is the remedy then?
So the remedy is an affirmance because there are alternate bases for post-conviction relief. And I was actually going to conclude with this point, but I'll make it now. The state has a remedy here. Judge Morley gave the state the opportunity to retry Mr. Kaiser. That is the path for the state. The path for the state is not to upend 90 pages of carefully considered and fully supported factual findings. So if you agree with us on either theory, pardon me, Judge Bjorkman.
I was going to have you talk about Gilbert Lieberg has suggested that has changed the landscape of the law on what constitutes false testimony and how we should review the record here in that regard. How do you respond to those arguments?
So Judge Bjorkman, I'll answer your question about Gilbert, and then I do want to just get back to one final point on ineffective assistance of counsel, if I might. But with respect to Gilbert, which I read yesterday after Mr. Lieberg made his filing, the testimony in Gilbert was quite different. First of all, there was no question that was opinion testimony. And in fact, the expert in Gilbert, as I read the decision, and I don't have the full context of the transcript in that case, said something to the effect of, I really just have to guess. There is no way, and I don't think it's any surprise that this court said when an expert guesses, that cannot be a false objective statement. In fact, the expert in Gilbert said, This is not an objective statement. This is merely my opinion. And in fact, it's more than that. It's guess. The district court here made a factual finding after reviewing the record that what Dr. Schmidt and Lynch did went beyond opinion. It was almost as though Judge Morley was anticipating the Gilbert decision when she wrote her decision. Because
how does what the judge found fit the definition of false testimony, the standard identified in Gilbert?
So because it's what Gilbert says, as I understand it, it held essentially that when an expert gives his or her opinion at trial, that just because another expert comes in after the fact and disagrees with that opinion, that can't be the basis for a false evidence claim. What Judge Morley found was that the statements these two experts gave at trial went beyond mere opinion and were really objective statements of fact regarding the current state of the medical literature. And that's, I think, how what we distinguish Gilbert and...
Well, the state argues, though, that there really isn't a difference between opinion and medical fact. So can you address that?
So opinion would be, my opinion is that Williams' hemorrhages were caused by abusive head trauma. That is the doctor's application of facts to the particular circumstance and rendering a medical opinion based on those facts. The difference is those doctors were not opining about William when they made those statements. They were asked more generally, what are the causes of macular schisis? And they were very clear, there really aren't any other than AHT. And that, I think, is what is a factual representation to the jury. There are no other causes. Whereas an opinion is, it is my opinion, taking those medically known facts and applying them to William, what caused his particular injury. I did want to make one last point in my remaining seconds here, that there is a interrelatedness in the district court's decision on the various claims that Mr. Kaiser presented. He presented a new evidence claim based on the fact that they discovered CVT after trial. Judge Morley rejected that claim, and she tied it to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. May I just conclude in 10 seconds, Your Honor? My time is...
You may.
She tied it to the ineffective assistance claim, saying on page 66 in denying our new evidence argument, had petitioner consulted with an expert who is qualified to review and interpret imaging studies, it is likely CVT would have been identified. So she's saying it's not new evidence because reasonably competent counsel could have discovered it. If you reverse, you're going to create an incongruity and an inconsistency in that order. If you apply the standard of review, we should win. All of the factual findings are fully supported by the record, and we therefore ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lieber, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Just briefly, and I said this in my reply brief, respondent's remedy on the denial of the new evidence claim was to appeal that. He didn't. He cannot use then the court's finding that this wasn't new evidence to somehow bootstrap his ineffective assistance counsel and making it an either or. He has chosen his pathway. He is relying on ineffective assistance of counsel. And therefore, if the court finds that ineffective counsel standard was not met, that's the end of the case. The court can't go back and say, well, I know you didn't appeal the new evidence, but we're going to find that it was new evidence. Before I attempt to address counsel's points on ineffective assistance of counsel, I guess I'd ask the court if it had any questions of the state on the ineffective assistance issue.
My only question is whether you agree that our standard of review is to look at the district court's factual findings for clear error.
It is, but it's also important to realize what a factual finding is. That is what counsel did or did not do, not whether it was deficient performance. And that's something that both the respondent and his expert conflate. When the court made judgment that certain acts or omissions were deficient performance, those are not factual findings. Those are legal conclusions, and those are owed no deference by this court. When the court made findings about what counsel did or didn't do, again, those are factual findings for clear error. And part of the entire problem with the court's order in this case and respondents' approach is that it completely eschewed the Strickland standard. In particular, the requirement that applying the Strickland standard, the court has to analyze counsel's conduct or performance or a particular decision under the facts and circumstances that existed at the time that decision was made.
Well, and this case was all about what scans showed about the child's brain and the eye scans. I'm not a doctor, but it does seem to me that one of your first lines of inquiry in defending and prosecuting, for that matter, would be to obtain the scans and find out what they show.
He did obtain the scans, and he provided those to his experts, including the first expert, Dr. Plunkett, was the first expert, and then to his other forensic pathologists, which he did not end up calling. And he told the post-conviction court, I rely on my experts to tell me if I need other experts. If you recall, during an earlier pretrial hearing, he had told the district court judge, I don't know which experts I'm going to call yet, because sometimes when I talk to one expert, they tell me I might need another. And he gave an example of a case where he needed to consult with a pediatric imaging expert because of a particular issue.
Any evidence here at the post-conviction hearing that defense counsel specifically asked any expert to review the retinal MRI CT scans? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Judge. I think the question that was asked him was, did you provide the medical records and the scans to your experts? And he said that he did. He did not give them to an imaging expert. And I want to get back to that particular point, because contrary to respondents' assertions, a significant, highly percentage of AHT cases do not have skull fractures. They are going to be based on medical imaging. That is going to be part of the state's case. So if the court finds here that it was deficient not to consult an imaging expert, I do believe that defense counsel is going to be stuck having no choice but to consult an imaging expert. But while the court said under the specific facts of this case, they didn't identify what specific facts in this case would have required an imaging expert, except for the fact that the state was going to be offering imaging testimony. Every AHT case is going to involve imaging. So
let me ask you this, Mr. Lieberg. Is it ineffective if a defense lawyer consults the wrong kind of expert?
It would be if it wasn't about anything relevant. I mean, if he had consulted an arson expert on an abusive head trauma case, one might question, why are you consulting that expert? He consulted with a forensic pathologist and his other experts that led him to his NEC defense. That is the defense that he chose to produce. He referred to that defense as, I believe the term was unchallengeable or indisputable or whatever. He had developed that as his trial strategy. Having found an alternative cause, that was the defense he went to. If I could finish, my thoughts on this, 10 seconds.
Yes, briefly, and I have one follow-up question for you.
So when he had that defense presented to him, that's the defense he chose to pursue. It wasn't like he wasn't given any defense, but under respondent's point of view, even with that defense and his decision that he wants to pursue that defense, he still would have needed to consult with an imaging expert because imaging was required at trial. And it doesn't matter to a certain extent that CBT was discovered later. There was nothing in the medical records or from his experts that told him that CBT was an issue in this case. And he told the post-conviction court, he relies on his experts to assist him in that. He knew what CBT was.
I have a question for you about the experts, and then you can briefly conclude. You said he testified that he relies on his experts. Is there any testimony that any of his experts had the expertise to understand or interpret those CT and MRI images that were provided?
Not specifically, but I would also note that respondents' experts during the post-conviction hearing, including his forensic pathologist and other experts, all testified about what those imaging results meant to them and what CBT was and how it could cause the retinal hemorrhaging. So it isn't just a imaging expert that can interpret those scans. particular. And again, as it relates to CBT, there's no guarantee that if he had consulted with an imaging expert, they would have noted CBT. None of the state's experts, and nobody appears to take issue that they are experts, noted the CBT or believed that it was relevant. So it's just as likely if he would have given it to an imaging expert, they also would have come back with that same result. Your Honor, I do believe, did the court have additional question?
No, does anyone else on the panel have any questions? No. Okay,
Your Honor,
you could just briefly conclude.
Yep, Your Honor, because I believe the court abused its discretion in granting a new trial, I would ask the court to reverse the finding of post-conviction relief and reinstate Mr. Kaiser's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you to both parties for your helpful briefing and for your oral arguments today. The court will look carefully at the issues and issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.